The misuse of the word misnomer is turning the word misnomer into a misnomer. The word literal has also become a misnomer. It no longer means the actual meaning of a word without metaphor or analogy. Now it's just used for emphasis. What does it mean that words are losing their meaning? Not only have we mistaken the map for the territory, but now the map is being fudged in order to fudge the territory. Maybe this is part of a perception management plan to further erode faith in the real, to turn everything into a kind of secondhand unreality. Every day, one's physical space is more and more endangered, while the value of virtual space and social media spaces becomes more inflated. The housing market seems too unstable to own a home or land. Car manufacturers now prohibit car owners from accessing the inner mechanics of their own vehicle. Paper money, which used to be a representation of actual gold sitting in a vault, has been replaced by credit card currency. And now there's even a digital currency called Bitcoin that's so abstract most people can't even explain what it is. Is it a decentralized virtual currency for a utopian future, or a Ponzi scheme for a dystopian present?
On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see.
You are listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley with Gib Strange.
How it will astound you.
Notes from Uncanny Valley is made possible in part by listeners like you. I have no corporate sponsorships, although I have approached the makers of Gold Bond medicated powder, as well as a well-known cat food company, and some kind of sex doll company in China. But I'm still waiting to hear back. So, in the meantime, I depend on donations. If you'd like to help out, please visit notesfromtheuncannyvalley.com and click the donate button. Okay, now that that's out of the way, let's see what's growing down there in the Uncanny Valley. I ride the elevator down with a skinny man in a baseball cap carrying a backpack. He has bad skin and holds a phone that plays Riders on the Storm by The Doors at an inappropriately loud volume. The man and I don't speak or even look at each other. We just patiently ride the storm down to the lobby. The elevator opens on the first floor, but when the man steps forward, the world suddenly goes silent, and I watch as the phone slips out of his hand and drops perfectly down the gap where the elevator platform and the lobby floor meet. It seems to happen in slow motion, and an unmistakable sense of déjà vu floods my mind as I stand here in the elevator. I remember this. I remember seeing the man drop his phone, and I remember watching it quietly fall through the crack. But how can I remember this already? I wonder as I stare at the dark space that has just swallowed the man's phone. This has been happening a lot lately. Why does it happen more often during some periods? Meanwhile, the man is verging on panic. He's thrown his backpack to the floor and is laying with his face pressed to the crack.
Oh shit, that sucks,
says Cindy, a smoker from the third floor who is standing outside the elevator holding a cup of tea and waiting to board. Awkwardly, I step over the man and join Cindy on the other side. The elevator keeps trying to close, so I reach out and hold it to keep it from knocking him in the head. Amazingly, the Doors music is still playing.
My girlfriend's gonna kill me. Do you have like a coat hanger or something like that?
The man asks without looking up from the crack in the floor. Cindy and I look at each other.
I don't think that's gonna help you much, buddy,
she says, taking a sip of tea. Cindy's right. The phone might as well have slipped into a different dimension. We listen as the sound of thunder and rain closes out the song. Then, another Doors song begins. Come on, come on, come on, come on, now touch me, babe, the phone cruelly taunts. Well, I say, doing my best to reassure the poor guy, the good news is that your phone's still intact. But this does little to calm the man down. And I guess the bad news is that, judging by the reverb, this elevator shaft is pretty deep, so I don't think a coat hanger's gonna do much good.
Plus that damn crack's only half an inch wide,
Cindy adds needlessly. The man doesn't look up from the crack.
Do you guys have a light?
The panicked man repeats.
Like on your phone?
I don't have a phone, I say, and turn to Cindy, who gives me an irritated look before reluctantly pulling hers out and turning on the flashlight feature. She points it down the crack.
I could see it,
he says.
It's right there. I just need something long enough.
Dude, Cindy grumbles. There's no damn way you're gonna reach that phone.
Wait, point it a little to the right. No, I mean the left.
So Cindy moves the light, apparently too far.
Back a little. Here, just give it to me.
No way,
Cindy exclaims.
You got a bad track record with phones.
I know I can get it if I just find something long enough.
Do you think Dan's left? I ask Cindy, though I already know the answer. It's Friday evening, which means Dan, the busy but always friendly maintenance man, has already gone home for the weekend. Look, unfortunately, I think you're gonna have to go without your phone for a couple days, I say. This is not what the man wants to hear.
Fuck!
He begins punching the floor.
Can't you call somebody?
I look out in the lobby, but no one is in the office.
You'll get it for you first thing Monday,
Cindy says, trying to reassure him. Do you live here? I ask.
No, I'm visiting my friend,
he says, sounding as if he's about to break into tears. Why don't you have your friend get it for you on Monday? I say, now aware that my arm is getting tired from holding the elevator door.
I know I can reach it, I just need to...
He trails off. Other tenants are coming home. They gather around the scene, and Cindy tells them what's happened. That sucks, they say as they wait for the second elevator. When he finally turns away from the crack in the ground, for the first time, I get a good look at the man. What I see is disturbing. His eyes are black holes, and I'm instantly afraid to look into them. The sores clustered around his face appear freshly picked, and his mouth looks like it's about to cave in. When he opens it to talk, I see only a few remaining teeth, leaning like tombstones in an aging graveyard.
You go up one floor and just hold the elevator there,
he says with spit flying from his lips.
And I'll see if I can pry this outer door open.
I don't know how I got enlisted for this plan. I try to explain that these machines have a safety mechanism that prevents tampering, but the man doesn't seem to hear me. Finally, he gets up off the floor and begins pacing around in the lobby. Relieved of my elevator holding duty, my poor arm drops to my side, and everyone gets on board. As the car closes, I hear Cindy singing along.
This is the end, my only friend, the end.
This situation is a good example of the most emotional person in the room controlling the room. This man's emergency is now threatening to become my emergency. But since it is not my emergency, and in fact, probably not an emergency at all, I decide to make my exit. Hang in there, man, I tell him as I leave. You'll get your phone back in a couple days. Is tomorrow a virgin, or have we lived it all before? Is tomorrow just yesterday disguised as tomorrow? Is tomorrow made of random factors and circumstance, perception and interpretation, bias and memory, genetic inheritance and familial karma? Is tomorrow built on the same neural architecture blueprints that today was based on? Is tomorrow a deterministic, mechanistic world operating on the informal destiny of cause and effect? Is tomorrow on rails? Tracks laid long ago by ghosts of ghosts? Is tomorrow a dream? Is tomorrow a recurring dream? Is tomorrow a memory? Is tomorrow a memory so painful that we've blocked it out? Is tomorrow made of freedom, or is tomorrow made of fate? Is tomorrow a virgin, or is tomorrow a whore that we owe much more than money? The night breeze through me as I float down the sidewalk. On the corner, I see a memorial at the base of a tree. Amidst the dried flowers, fallen leaves, empty beer bottles, melted candles, and broken glass, a Christ statuette has fallen from its cross. With his arms outstretched, out of context, Christ looks like he's exaggerating about a fish he caught. My eyes search through the wreckage, but the missing piece is nowhere to be found. which is probably for the best, since I'm unsure if reuniting Christ with his cross is the respectful course of action, or if this would amount to a re-crucifixion. As I'm turning away, something flashes in the corner of my eye. It looks like a cockroach crawling over the statuette, but when I look back, it's gone. The line outside the women's shelter is wrapped around the corner and down the block. I walk past the weathered faces, tired and cold. Some have children with them. One is a trans woman. No one speaks. A couple blocks from my building, a second-story corner apartment is glowing in the night. Because it has glass windows for walls, and the young man who lives there rarely shuts his blinds, his home often functions as a kind of terrarium, illuminated by the blue light of his enormous television. I stand across the street and watch as he plays a video game. I wait, but he never moves. His trance never breaks. I reach out my hand, as if to tap on the glass, like a child at the zoo. When I return to my building, the lobby is empty. I step inside the elevator, and it lifts off as the ghost of the Lizard King howls when the music's over. The sound resonates from the growing reverb chamber, getting bigger for the first few floors. Then, slowly fading. By the fourth floor, it's only the distant echo of a Doors concert in hell. Curious instances of collective false memories are gathering and spreading across the internet under the banner of something called the Mandela Effect. The title of this phenomenon refers to people incorrectly remembering Nelson Mandela's death as having happened in the 1980s while he was imprisoned. Other examples include the beloved children's book, The Berenstain Bears, which many swear was spelled Berenstein. Some claim the comedian Sinbad played a genie in a 90s kids movie, but this movie doesn't appear to exist. The list quickly grows to hundreds of false memories. Why do trivial details about childhood suddenly seem unreliable? The more entertaining explanations are metaphysical in nature. A rift in the time-space continuum has left us condemned to the wrong timeline, where we remember a past that never was. When did we slip into the wrong timeline? Was it the end of the Mayan calendar cycle? Was it when the Large Hadron Collider started messing around with the fabric of space-time to find the so-called God particle? Or was it around the time marijuana was legalized? Some propose that we inhabit a simulation, and because we are now creating simulations within the simulation, in the form of quantum computers and virtual realities, the parent simulation is being drained of its power, resulting in these little glitches. Some speculate that our simulation is aging and suffering from the slow deterioration of data known as bit rot. Of course, psychologists assure us that the problem involves the mind and not the matrix. Notoriously fallible, memory can be influenced and distorted by bias, association, imagination, and social reinforcement. Did Sinbad play a genie in a 90s movie? Or are people thinking of another movie featuring Shaquille O'Neal? Perhaps this example is related to a cognitive phenomenon known as cross-race bias, which makes it hard for people of one race to identify individuals of another race due to lack of early and meaningful exposure to other groups. In another racially loaded example, Why do some people remember that cotton gin inventor Eli Whitney was black? Are they confusing him with the inventor George Washington Carver? Surely the two names were next to each other on that third grade multiple choice test we were forced to take all those years ago. Back before we took a wrong turn in the multiverse. It's also worth noting that the phenomenon exposes America's sheltered provincial insensitivities. For example, while many in this country might remember Nelson Mandela dying in the 1980s, I doubt anyone in South Africa does. It's also interesting that the phenomenon often involves corporate brands. Wasn't the hot dog company Oscar Mayer spelled M-E-Y-E-R? Was Kit Kat spelled with hyphen or not? Why do these logos suddenly look strange to us now? It's as if capitalism itself is malfunctioning. Another theory is that the Mandela effect is some kind of psyop mass media campaign to make people doubt their perceptions and even influence ideological models of reality. Whoever the unseen force gaslighting us is, simulation overlords, deep state social engineers, or our own brains, the effect is unmistakable. Forrest Gump's catchphrase provides a useful metaphor within a metaphor. Most remember it being, "Life is like a box of chocolates." But replayed now, it appears to be, "Life was like a box of chocolates." Once, life was life is, but now, life is life was. Personally, I suspect that the daily information overload is beginning to surpass the limits of our minds. Maybe the more we rely on the internet as our artificial memory, the less reliable our organic memory becomes, causing our distant past to decay. A lot of examples involve language. Maybe the phenomenon is not so different from the way autocorrect has weakened spelling skills, or how we scroll so fast that we misread words. I'm constantly seeing words on a screen that aren't there. Today, while scanning through online headlines, I misread "plane obliterated" as "planet obliterated." Which reminds me, does anyone else remember there being ice at the North Pole? Tired eyes drift aimlessly over supermarket shelves, certain that somewhere in these colorful aisles there's a product that will make me feel better about the universe and my position therein. Of course, as with channel surfing, I know deep down that nothing in here is what I'm actually seeking. Bleached dry by the fluorescence overhead, my gaze leads me down the cereal aisle, where the expensive items stand at eye level and the cartoon mascots peer back from down below. It's late. How late, I'm not sure. Clocks and windows do not exist in this strange world, where neutral, omnipresent pop music completes the atmosphere of a timeless void. It's late enough that I don't see any other customers, though. The store seems to be conscious. It seems to know my every move. It's trying to exhaust me into an irrational state where my emotions will cause me to buy things I don't need. I think there are GPS apps available now to help people better navigate these consumer spaces. That's the premise, anyway. The other reality is that use of these apps will allow AI to better navigate the user's inner psychic spaces. The synthetic musk of the cleaning aisle stops me in my tracks, and I force myself to turn around. I move backwards to the more natural smells and textures of the produce section, where I stare at the mist showering the broccoli. The water makes it look more appealing, while also causing it to spoil sooner. I find myself reaching into the spray and then placing my wet hands over my face. The water brings me back to my senses. Water, origin of life. I use this momentary clarity to take action and navigate my way to the cat food aisle, where I select a variety of strangers' latest favorites, from salmon casserole to beef feast and gravy. I feel relieved to have found the only MacGuffin in this store that will actually make me feel a little better about the universe and my position therein. Whoever the lone cashier on duty is, they've left their post, so I make my way to a self-checkout machine where I'm startled by a face on the camera screen. It's mine, and it's even paler and more gaunt than the last time I saw it. That must have been many nights ago, when I was similarly startled by my own reflection while making my rounds as the amateur night watchman of my building. If I suspected that a secret world exists on the other side of a mirror, then I am certain one exists behind this camera screen. The cold eye of the artificial intelligence surveillance apparatus recording my transaction is said to protect this grocery chain from theft. I don't doubt the power of this observer effect. I'm sure just forcing people to look at themselves is enough to instill self-policing. I stare at Big Brother, wearing my face. The camera and the screen are located far enough apart that I see myself from an angle up above. So unlike with a mirror, I'm unable to look myself in the eye. After doing my own internal GPS work to try and determine where the camera is, I look up and then back down to find out if there is a delay. If there is a delay, it's not long enough for me to look into the past, into my own eyes. My skin almost looks blue on this camera. Hopefully the technology and supermarket lighting is to blame, I think, as I stare at the live video phantom face mimicking my every blink. An invisible loop seems to form from my eyes to the screen to the camera and back to my brain. Like a circuit of electricity, I feel it close as something passes from me and through this loop back into me. The more I look at my eyes, without looking into my eyes, the more I see something strange. As my lashes flicker and flutter, the eyes on the screen begin to make a transformation. Soon, they have taken on the appearance of strange black insects. I stare at these bugs, mounted to a white face. Whoever is collecting these specimens did not kill them before pinning them to this face. Yes, these beetles still have life in them. I watch as they twitch and crawl in place. I watch as they struggle in vain to escape. I've been checking myself out in the self-checkout machine for a while, when my trance is suddenly broken by an impulse item to the left of the machine. It's an individually packaged cookie with yellow and black frosting made to look like an emoji face. I stare at the snack product based on the digital representation of human emotion. The company that produced the cookie is called Emoji, the iconic brand. A better slogan would be, "Tastes like simulacra." The emoji cookie is winking at me, and I find myself wondering what this wink means. Is it an expression of sexual interest? Or an indication of an inside joke, a sly signal hinting at a secret, maybe some shared hidden knowledge or intention that only I can understand. My trance is interrupted once again, this time by the automated voice of the self-checkout machine, who asks if I need more time.
Everybody's talking at me, I don't hear words they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still, I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes.
I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on some dreams.
In the jungle, there's a parasitic fungus that penetrates the exoskeleton of ants. It grows inside their bodies, eating the ant from the inside. Soon, the ant is as much fungus as it is ant. Inside, the parasite surrounds the ant's brain, commandeering its motor system. It modifies the insect's behavior, forcing it to leave the colony and climb up to a leaf overlooking the path of the other ants. Then, it uses the ant's mandibles to grip the leaf and secure a sniper's perch. After the ant finally starves to death up there, the fungus emerges in the form of a stalk growing from the corpse's head. The stalk even knows which direction to grow in order to best position itself before erupting and raining spores down on the insects below. Sometimes, I think a similar parasite has infected humans. One that uses mind control technology to ascend specific individuals to great heights where their behavioral and ideological influence rains down on the public. What do you think of the doors, Dan?
They're okay,
shrugs the busy but always friendly maintenance man.
Why do you ask?
I'm asking because I'm trying to fill the silence as we make our way to the elevator. But I don't say this. Instead, I tell him more about the incident on Friday night. The Doors playlist must have been on repeat because the elevator music continued well into the next day. Sometimes I'd forget until the car descended and Mr. Mojo Rising came fading in. Fellow passengers would board, unaware that the elevator was haunted by the ghost of Jim Morrison. Sometimes I'd try to explain. Other times I was tired of telling the story and would simply shrug my shoulders and let them wonder. Many seemed unsure at first if the music was real or only in their heads. For instance, on Saturday night, I was riding down with Captain, an eccentric aging hippie who wears a scuzzy old captain's hat and lives on the 6th floor. As the chorus of Unknown Soldier bled in from the underworld, Captain thought he was having an acid flashback.
I saw him live in 68,
he said with a raspy voice.
Jim was wasted.
Then with a chuckle, he added,
I guess I was too, though.
Did you know Jim Morrison's dad was a naval admiral involved in the Gulf of Tonkin? I had asked. Ironic twist that the soundtrack to Vietnam would be provided by a singer whose father had provided the war. Coming out of his reverie, Captain had looked up and nodded, as though he were considering this new piece of trivia. Until recently, all I knew about the Doors was that, along with Pink Floyd, they're the music I've most often heard blaring loudly from the headphones of grimy burnouts on buses and in waiting rooms. But I did some reading up on the group over the weekend, and a few levels deeper into internet pareidolia, I found narratives about the entire 60s counterculture being a mind-control psyop manufactured by intelligence agencies. But when I began to share this research with Captain, he quickly interrupted.
Bullshit!
He snapped as he got off the elevator.
I was there. It wasn't like that.
By Sunday morning, the phone battery must have finally died, leaving only the ghost of the songs stuck in my head. I knew they were only in my head because I heard them even when I wasn't in the elevator. Apparently, the absence of the elevator music has left a void that my mind seems to be trying to fill. That's probably also why I'm making small talk with Dan right now. Amazingly, no matter how busy the maintenance man gets, the stress never seems to break his friendly demeanor. He just struts confidently to ground zero of each emergency, knowing only he can save the day. Arnold in 521 says Dan reminds him of an older version of Kurt Russell in Big Trouble in Little China. As I walk alongside the cool-headed cowboy, I notice that my own body begins to swagger right along with him. When we reach the elevator, he says, "Wait here," prowls aboard, pivots to the right, and, without looking, pushes the second floor button before strutting right back off the platform. He leans with his hand on the wall as the door closes and the car goes up, then pulls from his pocket a long, slender tool with a joint in the middle that he inserts into a hole in the elevator door. This appears to disable the machine and allows him to manually open the door onto the empty elevator shaft. As Dan pushes the contraption open, for a brief moment, I imagine discovering the body of the poor, eager Doors fan down there at the bottom, reunited in death with his lost phone. "Hold it," Dan says. "Don't let it close." I stand there at the precipice and gaze upon the hidden world of the elevator, now revealed to me. I'm not sure what I'd pictured, perhaps a dark dungeon of greasy machinery. It actually looks very clean and hospitable in here. The walls are painted a nice shade of green, like the green screen used to key in images in movies. I watch in awe as the car in the neighboring shaft glides upwards. It's not at all like the jerky, disorienting movement one feels on board. From the outside, the cars appear to lift off in a smooth, graceful motion. Dan must see the wonder on my face.
"Cool, huh?"
he says as he descends the ladder to the bottom of the mine. Somehow this seems familiar too. The echoes of deja vu continue.
"I found $50 down here once,"
Dan says as he picks up the man's phone and scans around the floor of the shaft. Dan saying this makes me realize that I too am half expecting to find something in here, and not just a dead body. It's almost as if, behind these elevator doors, I was hoping to discover a secret MacGuffin to lend meaning and purpose to my story. The quote by William Blake that inspired the name of Jim Morrison's rock group flashes in my mind. "If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up, till he sees all things through narrow chinks in his cavern." The scene behind this elevator door couldn't possibly be what Blake had in mind. What Blake described sounds almost like synesthesia, hearing colors and seeing sounds. Unless you've just taken a psychedelic substance, or you're an autistic person directly experiencing the intense world hypothesis, then your experience of reality is filtered by the neurotypical human sensory apparatus, which recreates the external world as a less overwhelming internal simulation. I guess in that sense, everyone is a simulation theorist. It's a good thing those filters are in place, since the undifferentiated chaos of the world is too much for our pattern recognition machine brains to handle. According to the intense world hypothesis, autistics shut down in order to protect themselves from infinity. I'd never considered this connection between the autistic experience and the psychedelic experience, although the fact that several key early tech pioneers were on the spectrum and also started off as psychonauts confirms an overlap. It certainly can't be a coincidence that Google, the major internet search engine, is named after the number for infinity, or that Xfinity, the biggest internet provider, is a variation on the word. Aldous Huxley, another cultural figure implicated by internet shadow narratives as a CIA asset, also referenced the William Blake quote in the title of his book about his psychedelic experiences with mescaline, The Doors of Perception. Since it is well documented that the CIA did conduct LSD experiments, my speculation that efforts have also been made to weaponize autism seems congruent. What the end goal is, I can't see from here, but a recent tech article flashes in my mind. It was about the Internet of Things, and how everything is being recorded and microchipped, and that soon, AI cartographers will be able to map infinity, the world in a grain of sand. Dan has climbed back up the ladder and joined me on the lobby floor.
Ring,
he says, handing the phone to me. It's for you. This is confusing and takes me by surprise, but I think he's making a joke. I look down at the phone he is holding in front of me. I see that it's cracked, which could have been from the fall, or it might have happened before that. Dan is still holding the phone when I finally say something.
Oh, it's not mine, I say. Isn't it your friend's, though?
He asks. I just rode down in the elevator with him, I explain, suddenly realizing that I don't even know the guy's name. Having exhumed the tomb of the unknown soldier, I have no idea what to do with the fallen phone next. We certainly can't call the man.
Okay,
I'll put it in the office, Dan says.
Gee, you sure are a good guy to help a stranger out like that.
Dan pulls the tool from the disarm mechanism, and I take one last look before the door closes. I didn't tell Dan about the fallen phone because I'm a good Samaritan. I did it to peer behind the curtain. Like the day I saw the repairman working on top of the elevator car, I felt as though I'd glimpsed the puppet strings that make the world go up and down. Now that I've also seen it from down below, I feel even more privileged. Although the contraption has produced no deus ex machina, nothing has been resolved. Behind the doors, I only found more and more doors. Jim Carrey derails red carpet interview with bizarre rant, reads the headline above a video clip gone viral. Not surprisingly, the bizarreness of his so-called rant is greatly exaggerated. In fact, spiteful would be a better word for the actor's behavior, as he tells a fashion TV host that the event is completely meaningless. Of course, he's already betrayed this sentiment by appearing at the event in front of cameras. When she points out this contradiction, saying, "But Jim, you got really dressed up for the occasion," he corrects her with a philosophical response. "There is no me. There's just things happening, and there are clusters of tetrahedrons moving around together." After a few more awkward exchanges, the interview ends with Carrie saying, "We don't matter. That's the good news." Though his words almost sound like those of a wise old man, his general manner is that of a petulant child. Perhaps those arrogantly displayed pearls of wisdom were born the same way all pearls are, the product of a coping mechanism for a sandy irritant within. But the irritation remains, and is also on full display. There are several layers to what was said by the cluster of tetrahedrons formerly known as Jim Carrey. At first, he appears to be a bug in the Hollywood machine, trying to expose the hollow spectacle of the entertainment industry, a world he must have hoped would make him happy when he was down at the bottom struggling for success and fame. I guess whatever he found at the top, it wasn't enough. I also wonder if he feels guilty for his contribution to the false idol factory. As suggested by the headline, upon being called vapid, the industry fired back by calling Carey crazy. They're wrong, of course. He's not crazy. And he's wrong too. He's not enlightened. On the contrary, rather than relinquishing his ego, he's clearly still very much a slave to it, I think, as I watch his public chest pounding. Behold, the celebrity who has transcended celebrity. He's not just calling out the fetishization of celebrity, though. He's preaching the old Eastern tenet that the self itself is an illusion. There is no me, there is no you, and none of this is real. I had never noticed the parallels between this philosophical rhetoric and the psychological defense mechanisms of dissociation disorder. Soon I am watching another interview with the actor in which he describes the pain and suffering he's endured, saying he's come through it all with a body, but no self attached to it. It's tough to be yourself if you don't have a self, he says. I wonder how Jim Carrey would score if he were to take the depersonalization disorder questionnaire. Have you not recognized yourself in the mirror? Do you feel like you're watching life on a movie screen? Do you spend a lot of time thinking about philosophical or religious issues, such as why we exist, whether we exist, who's really talking, and what time and space really are? There appears to be quite a few videos of the self-righteous actor advertising his obnoxious spiritual enlightenment. By spending so much of my own attention on Jim Carrey, I realize that I am being taken in by, and contributing to, the culture of superstar obsession. I read that his ex-girlfriend, a makeup artist, whose job it was to hide his imperfections, has committed suicide, and that her family is pursuing legal action against the actor for allegedly giving her STDs and supplying her with the fatal overdose. Could his enlightened dissociation be a reaction to guilt? A way to regain some kind of control over the narrative of his life? I find myself watching one more video. This one carries commencement speech at the Maharishi University, where students pay a hefty tuition to learn transcendental meditation techniques. He is dressed in a dopey, gold-colored cap and gown, recalling old drapes or upholstery. Looking like the great Bishop of Korn, at one point, he nearly invokes Plato's allegory of the cave, saying, "We are not the pictures on the film stock. We are the light that shines through it. All else is just smoke and mirrors." A film analogy from a film star. And in a sense, the actor might even be telling himself, "Don't worry, it's only a movie." This begs the question, is the star of The Truman Show suffering from The Truman Show delusion? Are we trapped in a feedback loop? Has the snake swallowed its tail? What happens when reality doesn't show up to the reality show? What will reality TV star presidents mean for The Truman Show delusion? Will the number of cases increase? As we slip further and further into unreality, will the condition eventually be viewed as ideological rather than pathological? After all, if someone as intelligent and influential as Elon Musk claims to believe that we live in a simulation, how can anyone else be diagnosed as delusional for behaving like the paranoid center of an artificial universe? My mind zooms out. I begin to speculate that this is all part of a larger information age side effect. Perhaps it's not even a side effect. For all I know, the effect is primary and intentional. Either way, the more information, misinformation, and disinformation we are overfed by our devices, the more suspicious we are about the world we exist in, including the very concept of existence. Could it also be that the Gnostic nature of conspiracy culture appeals to us because it taps into the profoundly mysterious feelings that every child knows so deeply? It's not just that the pyramids are miraculous and must have been built by aliens, or that it's too incredible for man to have landed on the moon, and therefore the Apollo missions must have been media trickery. It's that one's existence feels so inexplicable that reality itself must be some kind of illusion. On Thanksgiving, or rather, the day before Thanksgiving, the staff prepares food in the community room. Tenants make small talk around a table full of generic cola and bread rolls, while Todd and Laura bring food from the kitchen.
Yeah, getting to be that time of year. Hey, Connie, staying out of trouble?
Well, their defense isn't great this season, but what else is new, right?
There are 132 units in this building, and the turnover is pretty heavy, so some of the faces pouring in and out of the room are more familiar than others. Some really stand out, like the leathery face of the tall, thin man with the prominent Adam's apple who wears a coonskin cap, or the chatty young woman with eyebrows sloppily drawn onto her forehead, shouting enthusiastic hellos to people she sees across the room, or the weary woman who never smiles and whose name is Joy.
Sure got cold fast, didn't it? Seems like the cold front moves in earlier every year.
Hey, Randy, how you been?
Oh, can't complain, says Randy before proceeding to do just that.
More friends are dying. Todd, who is carrying a bowl of chips to the table, overhears their conversation, and a look flashes on his face that says he's worried that this talk of death will bring the party down. Some sit down on the couch before a muted football game. Some eat standing up. Some are smiling. Some are glancing around the room, looking for familiar faces to connect with.
Is anyone sitting here?
Cold enough for you yet?
Let's just say I wouldn't put money on tomorrow's game.
She's the girl in the wheelchair, right? Oh my gosh, she's beautiful. She should be a model. Is anybody sitting here?
Just when the room is getting crowded, the great big man who works construction enters with the decrepit old man in plaid, another familiar face with no name. The old man is sweaty and tired and can only eat certain foods. He needs something to wash his pills down.
That was delicious. I'm going in for round two. Did you hear Debbie's out of the hospital now?
Good. So she's okay then?
She's okay. Bill's not okay though.
What's wrong with Bill?
Bill's health problems are described with a mouthful of mashed potatoes.
At least Bill has Medicaid though. All these operations are costing Debbie a fortune.
Yeah, and then when we die, it's gonna cost another fortune just to bury our asses.
They bury you for free if they can't identify the body. That voice sounded like mine. I guess it was mine, since everyone is looking at me now. I must have said that out loud. God, this must be the first thing I've said today. And because I happened to say it during an unexpected quiet moment, an awkward tension fills the room. If they can't identify you, I hear myself repeat, then the city uses public funds to bury your body. I'm afraid I'll say it a third time, but fortunately, someone else says something else, and then the faces stop looking at me. Thank you. Something has changed inside the terrarium apartment I walk past at night. The young man has bought a new television, even larger than the last. The screen is so big that even from down here on the street, I can make out the words, "Enter the encryption key of the wireless network." Down in the bottom corner of the frame, there are arrow shapes that must correspond to buttons found on the remote control. The arrows point up, down, left, and right from a center circle that reads OK. In this case, the word OK means correct. It doesn't mean all right or good, as in, I feel OK. Sitting in the lower right-hand corner of a plain gray screen, the diagram looks like a compass on a big map of nowhere. The ambient bloom radiating from the flat screen bathes the apartment in a cool, almost cosmic blue light. The young man who lives in this apartment is sitting on the couch with his feet crossed on an ottoman. He appears to be passed out, and two dogs are drooling on either side of an untouched slice of pizza on a plate in the man's lap. I watch as the dogs pant and stare at the food. I can almost hear the poor tortured creatures whimpering in agony, and the man snoring. I have been watching for a long time now, just standing here in the cold, watching this little Norman Rockwell painting for the 21st century. An overworked man passed out in the glow of a brand new megalithic TV too complicated to operate, surrounded by animals too domesticated to eat the junk food sitting on their master's crotch. I get excited when one finally lurches up the man's leg, sending the remote control crashing to the floor, where its disemboweled batteries scatter. But the pizza is still sitting untouched on the man's lap, and the man is still asleep. So I wait. For a while, I thought I was dead. Then I was sure I was living in a simulation. Then, I thought I was a fictional character in a book I was writing. For a while, I was afraid I was going insane. Then, I thought I was dead again. But today, I finally realized the truth. The truth is, I myself am the simulation, a robot, an artificial intelligence. I've probably been programmed to write words like these as part of a new Turing test. This explains my compulsive need to scribble. I'm no different than that writing automaton in Paris. Every word I write is pre-programmed, even this word, cabbage. Now I'm wondering if the success of the test depends on human readers failing to pick my computer-authored writing out of a lineup. Since culture is the most valued evidence that humans are not only sentient and intelligent, but also somehow special, this test would hold much weight. Many sports and financial articles are already AI-authored, but an AI-authored piece of literature would have wider implications and represent an even larger milestone than the chess and Jeopardy victories of Deep Blue and Watson, respectively. Perhaps after some trial and error, my programmers have provided me with simulated experiences and false memories to enrich my writing. It could even be that in order to fool humans into thinking I'm human, I must first fool myself. I guess I'm not entirely there yet. This could be an explanation for my depersonalization and derealization disorder symptoms. I'm an AI, programmed to experience life as a human, but there have been some glitches. Maybe my confused sense of self will leave my story unfinished, one of many failed experiments on the road to more advanced AI. Eventually, one of my successors will trick itself and others so convincingly that the resulting book will even become a bestseller. This would be even more significant, because it would mean that the human reader prefers the AI's work to its own. The implication could even be that the two have met in the middle, with the human's taste having been conditioned by life in an increasingly artificial world. Remember that in order for an AI to pass the Turing test, a human being must also fail it. One night I'm writing a new piece in my head as I walk home through the parking lot by my building. I'm on the verge of a major breakthrough when I suddenly step in something. Even in the initial moment of impact, something about the mass and consistency tells me that not only have I stepped in shit, but that this shit is special. I look down. Yes, it appears to be human shit I've stepped in. My shaggy old toothbrush is overdue for a replacement anyway, so after limping into my apartment with one shoe on, I hunch over the toilet and use the brush to scrub deep into the tiny crevices that make up the rubber underside of the footwear. It's then that the scent not only confirms my suspicion about the species of the excrement, but also tells me that this individual's diet is not very healthy. As I clean up this disgusting mess, I refuse to feel sorry for myself. Who am I to complain about stepping in shit when I have a toilet and this person had to defecate outside? It's Thanksgiving, and I'm thankful just to have a roof over my head. After I toss the brush into the wastebasket and flush the toilet, I look up to find that stranger has been silently watching from the doorway the whole time. "Hey, stranger," I say. Her saucer eyes follow as I close the lid on the toilet and sit down. I'm trying to remember the light bulb that went off in my head just before I stepped in human shit, but I'm afraid it's gone now. I sigh and lock eyes with my cat. "Did you hear the one about the computer who stepped in shit?" I ask. Stranger stands quiet and motionless. "It had to reboot." Maybe the ultimate Turing test will involve AI-written jokes. The last laugh.
On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are.
You have been listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm very thankful to last month's donors. Thank you, Stephen, Darren, Ian, Lincoln, and Tara. Between these kind souls, there was nearly enough to cover the cost of web hosting, so that's great. Thank you guys very much. Because of you, the site will remain available for future eyes and ears. Thanks to Ryan for his help with music. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you've enjoyed it. If the momentum keeps up, I think I'll do a Christmas episode. Feels like a good way to end the year.
Let the glow of your being outshine.